Right, let's get the ball rolling. Good morning, everyone. We are doing all right this morning. So, quick look at the schedule. We're going to talk a little bit about the life of Muhammad, and then hopefully today we're going to get into the Quran. We've gotten up in terms of the overview of the life, I think, up until what Hijra and then the battles of Badr and Uhud. I'm going to do a little bit more on that, talk a little bit about Muhammad's marriages. One thing that we had started talking about is Jewish-Muslim relations last time and how two are gradually going their separate ways, you may say, how tensions are growing, so we'll talk a little bit more about that. But before we do all of that, we had started toward the end of last Gesundheit, last time, this comparison, right? So we have read four last time chapters out of Leila Ahmed's book on the position of women in early Islam, and we read Fatima Mernissi's chapter on that, kind of observing the large question, I think, to a certain extent, was it's of course a little bit more complicated, that both authors are raising is the question of how did women fear, or what the transition was from pre-Islamic to Islamic times, right? And I had cautioned you toward end of last session that they actually put at least slightly different slant on the question. So I'd ask you to revisit the chapters and make a couple of observations on how each author actually sees it. So let's start with that. What did people find when comparatively looking at those two authors and how they characterize this transition? What happens to the rights of women from pre-Islamic to Islamic times? From the term I think we had talked about already, right? Jahiliyyah, everybody? Did we talk about Jahiliyyah? Okay. This time of ignorance, this time of barbarity, right? From Jahiliyyah to Islam, things change. That's what both of our authors say, right? So how do they change? So here again, Jahiliyyah and Islam. How do they change, and what specifically changes for women? And your names again.
Alice.
Alice.
We talked about this a little bit at the end of last class, but Mernissi talks about how one of Muhammad's wives asked him why women weren't represented, and he had a revelation that they were equal as believers, and also that they should have equal inheritance.
Okay, so equal as believers, equal inheritance rights, equal as...
Yeah.
So inheritance rights over here, right? Inheritance rights. As opposed to what? In pre-Islamic times, according to Fatima Mernissi, what is it with inheritance and women? She makes the observation on that.
He said that they were
she
down.
Actually, Fatima and Layla, both are she's, both are women.
That women were passed down to their son-in-laws or sons after their husband.
Okay, so women are inherited, right? They are chattel. Just like you inherit the dog of the family or the cow or the camel of the family, you inherit women of the family. That's how it works in pre-Islamic times, she says. Right? So according to Fatima Mernissi's inheritance rights versus in pre-Islamic times, women were considered chattel. Right? Like Adam's property. Radical change, right? You're seeing that? If that is true, wow, Islam really radically changes the position of women. In pre-Islamic times, they were not considered human beings, right? They become considered human beings with their own individual rights in Islamic times. So Islam then is a radical step forward for women. The Quran / Muhammad as the proto-feminist of the Arabs. You're following the argument? Okay. Others? On Mernissi or on Ahmed?
Alexis.
Yes, Alexis.
In Mernissi, they talk about how Islam institutionalized like the separation period. So they're saying before, like, it didn't matter if the woman was pregnant and where like the child went to.
Okay.
And then after Islam, like, they had to wait for like some menstrual
cycle. Okay. Which one now?
That was
Mernissi. Okay. So in pre-Islamic times, do that again. And the page number? Let's look at it.
It's 52.
Okay.
Last paragraph on that page. They're saying that in pre-Islam, it didn't matter, like, linking the child to the father. But in Islam, they, like, waited after separation to make sure, like, the woman wasn't pregnant.
Okay. Which chapter are you actually on? A different chapter, right? You're on the chapter of Hadith.
I'm going down there. Attribution of
misogyny, yes. That's actually for later, because it messes with my argument. And what is happening there, not that it's really messing with my argument, that's Hadith, that's later developments. Very much so, patriarchal structures are entering, so that's the argument that Fatima Mernissi is going to be making, that Muhammad himself, cool, fine guy, right? It is after him when men take over and men now, in a sense, reduce all of the gains that women have made. But you're a step ahead of us. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, it just doesn't fit my argument, so I'm going to shut you down.
That's good. I'm sorry.
Okay. 1 minute.
And
Kelsey, yes.
In the Ahmed book, it talks about how Umar's reign was when a lot of the institutions of Islam were sort of formed, and that was bad for women.
Okay, do that again. My hearing.
It says during Umar's reign.
Okay.
It's the period when the new.
So you're also ahead of the curve, right? So, well, not really. It's in the chapter.
Yeah.
But what both of them have in common is kind of over here. Then we have Umar ibn al-Khattab, a contemporary of Muhammad, who will take over later, and he's going to institutionalize more patriarchal structures, etc., etc. But Muhammad himself, so Umar is in there. On Jahiliya, so. And this just as one sample, you could play this for a long time. So Jahiliyyah, bad, bad, bad for women, gets really good under Islam. And what does Leila Ahmed say on Jahiliyyah? Actually, Sammy, you are waiting, and then
Elena.
Just right off the bat, in page 42, she said that Islamic Arabs quoted the fact that they condemned Jahiliyyah's old, like, institution of, like, picking the sexes.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the quotes says, when one of them is told the birth of a female child, his face is overcast with gloom and he's deeply agitated.
Okay.
So Islamic texts, like, apparently disagree with that, and they say, no, that's wrong.
Okay.
They actually accept that for women, but Ahmed goes on to continue through, like, the whole chapter.
Right.
Especially towards the end of Umar's reign, just, like, saying...
Right. So there is a little bit of an egalitarian, and that would be one of those examples. But on pre-Islamic women, she has these lines. Oh, sorry, Elena was waiting.
I mean, I know that she was back. I don't know what the page number is, but I know that she said about, like before they had, like, matriarchal. It wasn't really, like, I mean,
right.
It wasn't paid.
So we have some matriarchal structures, matriarchal structures, not fully, but there are at least samples of matriarchal structures in there. What else? There's this famous line that has been quoted by a lot of folks. Women were priestesses, they were poetesses, they were warriors in pre-Islamic times. Look at all of them, pre-Islamic women, they could do whatever they wanted. You can grow up and be whatever you want in pre-Islamic times. I think it's on page 67, if I remember correctly. Let me double check whether my memory is good. Not so good. No, it's not. Because I really want you to see, and of course, many of you have just given me counterexamples that kind of mess a little bit with my argument, but I still will maintain that overall speaking, there is this difference in tone. So, for example, 42, greater sexual autonomy for women in Jahiliyyah, right? They can do their own thing. 44, she talks about polyandrous marriages. That is to say, let me do vocab here somewhere. We have a couple of different terms that we need to learn. We have polygamy. We have polygyny, and we have polyandry. All of them have poly in common, multiple, right? But then they have different endings here. Polygamy, everybody knows what polygamy is. Mm-hmm. Polygamy is what? Somebody, quick definition, one sentence.
Multiple gods.
No, that's polytheism, right?
Sorry.
That's multiple gods. Polygamy.
Multiple wives.
Area, right?
Area, yes.
Yes. Multiple wives and or multiple husbands. This is an inclusive term. It can go either way. A male may have multiple female sexual partners. A female may have multiple male sexual partners and other possibilities, right? So that's the inclusive term. Whereas these are more specific. Polygyny, gynecology,
multiple wives.
And the adverse, polyandry, andros, male, multiple male partners. Right? So what Leila Ahmed is saying, in pre-Islamic times, women were allowed to have multiple male sexual partners. Right? So it was egalitarian. A male may marry more than one female, but a female may also marry more than one male. That's egalitarian, right? That changes, right? So polyandry in there. Divorce and remarriage for both male and female.
I was about to say that on page 44, it talks about, like, in pre-Islamic times that there was not a waiting period for after divorce for women to go and get remarried. Right. But in Islam, there was.
Okay, so a waiting period gets introduced. Of course, the waiting period is about, we don't have any pregnancy tests yet, so you wait for 4 months and you see whether you're pregnant. But it's ultimately speaking about patriarchal right to determine the father of the baby, right? And the waiting period obtains for females and not for males. So again, it's an inegalitarian practice in Islamic times that you don't have in pre-Islamic times. You all following how these various factoids, another one I think on 53, women participating in war, Hind. Both talk about Hind. You all remember Hind, right? And they talk about Hind in different ways. I think it's on page 53, onwards, according to my notes. Hind as a positive example of warrior woman who is allowed to participate in war. Right? It's a good thing. Right? Whereas in Myrnesi she comes across as, you know, kind of a problematic figure. Right? But participation in war in pre-Islamic times. And all of this stuff, Leila Ahmed says, becomes more and more problematic in Islamic times. Are you following the overall argument? So she is saying pre-Islamic times, wonderful, but with exceptions. And in Islamic times, many of those rights are being curtailed. Okay, you don't have opportunity. No, if you grow up as a woman in Islamic times, you can no longer be what you want to be. Right? I hear a lot of silence. I assume that you all... Lauren, right?
Yes, Lauren. And I'm just wondering, in emergency, if you can correct me if I got this wrong.
Okay.
She talks about how before women were essentially like spoils of war, like they were
right.
What you would conquer afterwards.
Exactly, exactly.
And then she talks about later on, I forgot who it was either a wife or something, but it's talking about women actually wanting to gain something from
right.
war.
Right, exactly. And they want to participate, right? And she's talking about this a little bit, that women are pushing Muhammad. We would like to participate, and of course the egalitarian Muhammad of Myrnesi should allow for that, but then he has to make compromises, right? So there is this one line in there that we probably can talk about for a second. When you go to, where was this again? Okay, so we're on page 139. So the women push... We want to participate in war. We don't want to be chattel no more. We don't want to be spoil of war. We want to be participants in war and also economically benefit from that. And the guys are saying, no, no, no. That would mean that, you know, we don't get as much, right? And he's giving it. So this difficult choice, equality of the sexes, or survival of Islam. In other words, what Myrnesi is saying here is, if he'd given in that much, then probably the men would have by the wayside, right?
faced with this difficult choice, the genius of Muhammad and the greatness of his God shows in the fact that at least at the beginning of the 7th century, the question was posed and the community was pushed to reflect about it. So women didn't get the full right to participate in war, become warriors, and unite and gain economically from participation, but at least it was raised. So what Myrna Seed is trying to say is, look, Muhammad's a good guy, he is a feminist, he was just a victim of his own time, he had to make that compromise. Do you see how that argument works? Okay. Not that we need to be convinced by it, but that's what Myrna Seed is arguing. So what I want you to see is that we have two authors, both of them will ultimately make claims that Islam is not a misogynist religious tradition overall, that there are egalitarian moments in there. Both of them are very much making the argument that there is distinct potential for Islam to be an inclusive religious tradition. But when it comes to the specific question, pre-Islamic times versus early Islam, they come to different conclusions based on the same evidence. My major point in all of this is, we had talked about it last time, that when it comes to pre-Islamic times, when it comes to early Islam, our historical evidence is slim. What we have comes from later times. So the stories that we're basing ourselves on, whereas the Quran itself is not a big problem, it is a contemporaneous document. The hadith and the stories about the life of Muhammad are later, and things happened. That is to say, what we have in those texts is not necessarily reflective of what really happened on the ground. And one of the biggest problems is Jahiliyyah. We know very little about Jahiliyyah. We have contradictory evidence. So, for example, one fact that we do know, we studied this actually a couple of days ago, when it comes to the question of Jahiliyyah and inheritance over here, Mernissi seems to suggest that in pre-Islamic times, women were inherited. They didn't inherit things themselves, they were just passed on in the family. We know at least of one example where that is not true. What is that one example? Sammy, you have an answer to that.
Muhammad's wife, right?
Muhammad's wife, Khadija. Right? Khadija operates her own business. How'd she end up with the business? If she didn't inherit it, if she didn't have property rights. Right? She offers herself to marriage to him. She's not inherited by him. Right? So there's at least one counterexample. So I want you to see that, of course, it's a very charged question. The other thing that I want you to see is that the construction of Jahiliyyah itself is somewhat problematic. We do not know a whole lot about Jahiliyyah. What we do know is that most Muslim authors of the early time period construct a very stark contrast between pre-Islamic and Islamic times, making the argument in pre-Islamic times things were very different from the way that they are now. And some historians suggest that this narrative is actually a narrative construction in order to look good. You make somebody else look bad, right? We do it all the time. American history is full of it. Traditional, of course we don't tell the story like that no more, but the traditional narratives about the settlers coming into an uninhabited desert and bringing civilization to a people, some Christian discourse, early Christianity, as opposed to backward Judaism, bringing improvement, right? So there's oftentimes this construction of we are the good guys, you're the bad guys. We actually saw it the other day when we talked about Orientalism as well. We civilized Europeans, bring civilization to them, backward Orientals, right? So what you probably have here then in talk about Jahiliyyah is another such binary construction that really doesn't base itself on historical facts, but is a ideological construct to make yourself look good. You are following that section? Good. So much for, we're going to come back, obviously, to many of these questions.
So what I want to do now is, we had talked a little bit about the life of Muhammad. We had gotten about to the year 624, and so I want to just finish that narrative. This is where Tagore is going to be bored again, so if you want to read sociology or something like that, go ahead and do that. So I want to finish that story, and then I want to get into a first basic stab at the Quran. Obviously, that's where we're going to be continuing the next couple of days. So when it comes to the life of Muhammad, again, back to Hijrah, the Exodus as the momentous event in Muslim history, a persecuted religious community leaves Mecca and moves to Yathrib / Medina. The full title of the town, Madinatul Nabi, is one way of putting it. This is where we get Medina. Medina just means the city, and the full title is the city of the Prophet. Right? So Yathrib becomes Medina. Renaming of cities is something that you find in other contexts as well. Most famous example is, of course, Byzantium, which becomes Constantinople, the city of Constantine, right, and then becomes Istanbul when the Turks get it. Muhammad and his community moves. Again, Muhammad had expected that the Jews of Medina would welcome him with open arms, that they would recognize him as a new prophet. He's about 1,000 years late with that expectation. The book is closed for Judaism, so tensions rise between Jews and Muslims. And tensions become severe. Again, that's where the change of the direction of prayer, the Qibla, is coming in. A first indication that Jews and Muslims no longer are on the same page. Right? And those tensions increase. And then, of course, now two major challenges for Muhammad and the growing Muslim community. One of them, the enemy of Mecca, is still out there. That is to say, the Meccans had forgotten about Muhammad. There's still strong tensions. There are some indications that the Meccans actually want to interfere with Medina. There are some fear of loss of life. And so this leads to, and the question of who is the originator is a very complicated one, but it leads to a number of battles. So we have three major battles that we ought to know. The first one, Badr, in the year 624. Again, that's the most miraculous of the three. In this situation, a Muslim army of about 300 warriors is able to defeat an army three times the size. The Quran talks about it, that actually angels were fighting on the side of the Muslims to help them out. And that one win actually leads to Muhammad and his community all of a sudden winning the respect of the surrounding Arabian tribes. Right? So it's really a major miracle. On the side of the losers, Abu Sufyan, we had seen that guy earlier. He's the husband of Hind, right? He now becomes nominally the leader of the Muslim, of the Meccan opposition. Hind loses many of her relatives, totally enraged. That is what brings her to effect revenge during the Battle of Uhud. And the Battle of Uhud for us is interesting on a number of different scores. One of them, it's an almost loss for Muslims. They are lucky that they weren't fully defeated. This is kind of the brink of disaster that they are on. The other important thing is that the sources that we have, now these are later sources, but they exclaim in one way or another that women participated in battle. And what is interesting to see is that some of the earlier sources say, Ibn Ishaq, for example, says, on the polytheist side, you had women participating in battle, but they're quiet on the Muslim side of things. Right? So there is this portrayal, the polytheists, these barbarians, look at them, they don't have their women under control, women are out on the open battlefield. That's so uncivilized. In a patriarchal society, you expect women to be protected by men and not out and open in the battlefield, right? Whereas later sources actually make the argument, no, both Muslims and non-Muslims had women participating in the battle, right? So this is where some of these uncertainties that we saw earlier with Leila Ahmed and where does he come from, that we have early sources already disagreeing on the question of women participating in battle. So that's the second one. So women participating in all likelihood, historically, politically speaking, probably on both sides. And then the third battle is the Battle of Al-Khandaq, the trench. This is actually a siege on the town of Medina. So the Meccan forces come out and besiege the city. There's only minor fighting going on. Overall speaking, it's a siege that is unsuccessful. The Meccans come in with a large army. Muslims and Medinese hunker down in town. There's a couple of skirmishes, and then after a while, the Meccans realize they can't take the city. They leave. End of story. Now, those three battles are battles against external enemies. But what is also happening is that every single time that you have a battle against an external enemy, there's also some military action against an internal, quote-unquote, enemy. That is to say, each of these three battles also involve military action against one of the three major Jewish tribes. This is a further outgrowth of these growing tensions between Muslims and Jews. Right? So the first two times, you have the expulsion of entire Jewish tribes and confiscation, actually in the second case, I think, of the property. And in the last case, you actually have the execution of an entire Jewish tribe. Footnote on this. This third case of the story about an execution of an entire Jewish tribe is not in all of the early sources. There are some early sources that dispute that an entire Jewish tribe of about 600 men was executed by the Muslims. What is interesting to observe is that you have nowadays different factions in the historian community. And what is furthermore interesting is that, you know, there's a lot of ideology involved in the question of whether this tribe was executed or not. There's, oversimplifiedly speaking, two camps in Islamic studies, early history. There are the traditionalists, Muslims and some non-Muslims, that say early Muslim sources, even though they were written 150 years after the fact, are all hugely, always reliable. Muslims never lie, right? So whatever we have in the sources is always true. And then you have the hypocritical faction, Western Oriental scholars, that say, can't trust anything you read in Muslim sources unless you can verify it through outside sources such as archaeology, right? So you have those two factions. When it comes to this particular story, all of a sudden, both factions change their tone. The super critical Western scholars tell you, can't believe anything you read in Muslim sources except for this one. That one you can believe, right? And on the traditionalist side, you have the story, or you have the assertion, you have to believe everything that you have in early Muslim sources because Muslims never lie, except for this story, right? So you can kind of start guessing why may one or the other say that. Why may an Orientalist critical camp say, don't believe anything but this story? And why may a traditionalist Muslim storyline go the opposite way? Believe everything but this story. What's going on here?
They have biases.
They have biases, right? Exactly. So nasty Orientalists want to confirm Muslims are bad, bad, bad. Look at this, right? And the traditionalists want to say the opposite. We are very fine people. We never do anything wrong. Don't believe that story. So, where's the truth? Very hard to say. I just want you to be alerted a little bit to kind of these biases in dealing with the text. So, overall speaking, undeniable. What we have in the early history of Muslim-Jewish relations don't look good, right? I mean, already in the first decade of Jewish-Muslim relations, you have this stuff going on. Muslim traditional sources assert the reason for these expulsions and the execution lies in the fact that the Jewish tribes of Medina collaborated with the enemy, right? They engaged in treasonous behavior. That is to say, when the Meccan armies move, the Jewish tribes collaborate with the enemy. If you look at it from that perspective, punishment for treason in late antiquity, in medieval times, into modern times is what? Death, right? So that explains it from one perspective, but still it doesn't look good, right? This looks really bad. And then you may be tempted to believe early Jewish-Muslim relations, already in the first decade, look pretty bad. Contemporary Jewish-Muslim relations look pretty bad. So for the last 1400 years, we have had pretty bad Muslim-Jewish relations. And I would caution that that's actually not the case. I would say this is an exception, and the 20th century is an exception, each for particular historical circumstances. But apart from that, the other 1,200 years of Muslim-Jewish relations actually don't look all that bad, particularly when compared to Jewish-Christian relations. Many of you are familiar that Jewish-Christian, with the fact that Jewish-Christian relations don't look all that pretty, right? It, from about the 4th century onward, where Christianity becomes the official religious tradition of the Roman Empire, things degenerate by the 6th century, outlawing of Jewish-Christian marriages, Jews forbidden to have government posts, crusader time, you have attacks on Jewish communities by Christians, you have entire massacres in the context of the call to the First Crusade, where Christian men of Europe ask, you know, why should I go and fight the infidel in territories thousands of miles away while I have the infidel living among ourselves in Europe? And so you get Jewish communities massacred in Germany, for example, in various towns. And then you have the bubonic plague, one third of the population of Europe dying because of the plague. And guess who gets blamed for that? It was the Jews who poisoned the wells of Europe, and you have massacres on the Jewish communities. You have accusations of Jews killing Christian boys, so-called blood libels. Anybody in this class ever heard of blood libels? Nobody heard of them? Okay, one, two. Accusation in medieval times. And you have them in Germany, you have them in England, you have them in Austria, one or two in France. And the accusation was something like this. Jewish boy was missing somewhere, the Jews did it, right? And the accusation is that Jews need Christian boys for Passover to drink their blood or to make matzah out of Christian boys, which is absolutely ridiculous. Those of us who know Jewish dietary law know, among other things, well, human flesh you don't eat at all, but you don't even drink blood, right? What some historians actually suspect is going on here, it's kind of a perverse inversion of Christian theological doctrines. And this is going to sound a little bit offensive to you, but you may think about the Christian doctrine of communion and Eucharist as the fact that the eating of flesh and drinking of blood of a Jewish boy crucified brings salvation. Right? You are following what I'm saying here in a very offensive way, right? So if a Christian has to drink the blood of a Jewish boy to achieve salvation, then it stands to reason to expect that a Jew may need the blood of a Christian boy. You're following that perverse logic, right? So that is one explanation for blood blood. So again, this is all a footnote on, you know, bad relations with Jews. Well, Christianity takes the crown on that, I would say. Western Christianity does, right?
We read an entire book on this in one of my modern European classes with Dr. Day called The Butcher's Tale. It was about, a great book.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book, is one way of describing it. It's an awful story.
Yes,
it's an awful story. 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, the other thing that happens is Jews get kicked out of Iberia Peninsula. Right? And many of those Jews actually end up in Islamic lands. It's actually the Muslims that take in these Jewish communities. Morocco to this day has Jewish communities that go back to 1492 that were taken in under Islamic rule. Constantinople, Istanbul. We traveled there a couple of years ago. There are Jewish communities in Istanbul that trace their descent to 1492, right? That were invited by the Sultan, that actually speak to this day, at least in their folklore, Ladino, that is to say, the language of medieval Spain. Right? So, yes, this looks bad. And yes, the 20th century looks pretty bad when it comes to Jewish-Muslim relations for particular historical reasons. You can all guess what the big reason is. Right? In between, that is to say, 9th century all the way to the 18th century, it's not, you know, flower power kind of, you know, Berkeley harmony in the Middle East, but it's a whole lot better than what Jewish communities experienced under Christendom. So, sorry, long footnote, but I just don't want to have you under the impression that, you know, this is the end of the story. Okay, so back to it. The relations definitely getting worse and worse. For Muslims, though, after Al-Khandaq in particular, after the Battle of the Trench, things are improving. That is to say, they are able, Muhammad is able to secure alliances with surrounding tribes and gradually getting into a stronger position, and all of that will lead, ultimately speaking, in 632 to the conquest of Mecca. Right? So the folks that have been expelled from Mecca will actually be able to take Mecca back in a bloodless conquest. There's altogether a handful of people that are dying in this conquest. If you think about the troops, it's about 10,000 men that are moving on Mecca, take it peacefully. That's not a whole lot. Okay. First thing that Muhammad does once he conquers Mecca is he goes to the Kaaba, the shrine that at this point in time houses the 360 gods, according to Muslim tradition, right? The bad Jahiliya, the bad pre-Islamic polytheism. He cleanses the Kaaba of the idols and rededicates it to the worship of the one true God. Right? So here the story comes full circle. This is what I said earlier. Muhammad is not really the founder of a new religion, but he is rather better understood as a reformer, along the lines of Martin Luther, you may say. That is to say, the claim, of course, is that the Kaaba itself is the ancient shrine of Abraham, who built it for the worship of the one true God, and the Arabs have forgotten that monotheism is what they ought to be doing. They started worshipping multiple gods, and Muhammad recalls them to the original religion of Abraham. So here the circle closes itself. Muhammad rededicates it to the worship of the one true God. He lives another 2 years, dies in 632. Shortly before his death, according to Muslim accounts, the last verses of the Quran come down, more or less something along the lines, today I have completed my religion, and the religion is Islam, right? So the God says, okay, this is the last verse, book closed, right? And then shortly after that, Muhammad dies. Muhammad is not buried in Mecca, but in Medina. And that explains now the three most sacred cities in Islam, Sunni Islam in particular. Which are? What are the three big cities now? And why? Say what?
Medina.
Okay, Medina is one of them. What's the most important one? Mecca, and why? Kaaba. Abraham. All of these glorious stories of God's achievements happening in Mecca, right? First temple ever built to God, Mecca. Right? So that's number one. Number two, Medina. Why Medina? Was the first capital of the Muslim empire, the community, and then Muhammad and other heroes buried there. And then number three?
Is it Jerusalem?
Jerusalem. Exactly. Why? And your name?
Kara.
The Dome of the Rock. Dome of the Rock, commemorating what?
Where you said the Tower.
Israel Mirage, right? That's where our super sonic donkey was landing before he goes up in there. So those are the three cities. Okay, so much in a nutshell, Muhammad's life. We're going to come back to some of that. Now, one more thing that we need to quickly talk about is Muhammad's marriages. Right? Particularly after the year 624, well, actually starting in 619, I would say, Muhammad marries. So the first one, 619, we had talked about that one. No, sorry, 595 is the first one, of course. Muhammad marries Khadija. As long as Muhammad is married to Khadija, he is living a monogamous lifestyle. Khadija herself dies in 619. We had seen the marriage of Muhammad and Khadija produces children. All of the boys, as according to most traditions, three different boys out of the marriage die. The daughters survive. Out of the daughters, the most important one is going to be Fatima. She is going to marry Ali ibn Abu Talib. Does anybody remember Abu Talib? If I say Abu Talib ibn Abdul Muttalib, does anybody recognize him now? Abu Talib is the uncle of Muhammad, the guy who took him in, right? So Ali is the son of the uncle, which makes him son of uncle is cousin. So cousin is marrying daughter. That's not unheard of. You have to remember that oftentimes parentage is not necessarily the same. So these can be through different wives. Actually, top of my head, I actually don't know whether there are different wives involved. Out of that marriage, we have two sons, Hassan and Hussein. This guy in particular, we're going to come back to. You want to remember Hussein, you want to remember Fatima, you want to remember Ali. Okay. The other daughters, if you want to remember them, great. If not, that's fine too. So, Khadija now dies in 619, and Muhammad remarries. The interesting fact is that he remarries more than once. Two wives. One of them, Aisha. Actually, all of the wives we're going to talk about much more detail later. I'm just giving you the list right now. We're going to think about it in very broad terms. Aisha bint Abu Bakr. He is going to be the first successor to Muhammad, Abu Bakr. So the daughter of the first successor to Muhammad. And Muhammad is going to marry more, particularly after 624. Okay. And so a couple of very general observations right now on polygamy in general, and polygyny, G-Y-N-Y, more specifically. Jahiliyyah versus Islam, there is no big change. In pre-Islamic times, polygyny, and if Fatima Mernissi is correct, probably also polyandry, were practiced in the area. Muslims are not the first ones who practice polygyny. Those of you familiar with the Bible know that there are a couple of polygynous marriages in pre-Christian times, right? The most famous one is Solomon. How many wives did Solomon have? A lot. A couple hundred, 700, 1,000, not many of them. Christianity has probably a little bit more explicit rules on marriage and monogamy. Judaism, actually, up until the 10th century, did not have specific injunctions against polygamy, right? Of course, it's in the Bible. So that's one observation. And then another observation is that, of course, with Orientalist mindsets and with white male fantasies about the harem, you may be inclined to believe that polygyny is primarily about sexual gratification of males. And that's not necessarily the case, right? So this is not about super macho just accumulating as many wives as you can get. There's other stuff going on. There are various types of marriage, and of course you can probably come up with your own taxonomy, but I'm just going to, for now, suggest a couple of motivations that may lead a society to adopt polygyny
polyandry or some other system to suit its own goals. One of them is politics, and that's something that European dynasties also know pretty well. Right? So a reason to marry may not necessarily have to do with 19th century notions of love and romance. They may have to do with very practical matters, such as politics. If you have a prince and neighboring principality or kingdom has a princess, and you're interested in a larger kingdom, or good relations with the kingdom, one way to make sure that the relations are good is have the two of them marry. Right? Now you're related, and that will decrease chances of tension between the two. Right? That's something that European history is full of. Marriage politics. Right? That's something that's going on in some of these. So, for example, as I said, Aisha, for example, as the daughter of a very important early figurehead in Islam, is one such example. If you look at the earliest caliphs, those of you who've taken history of Islam or others before know Abu Bakr is the first one, Umar ibn al-Khattab is the second one, so here we have another daughter that is married. Here we have a daughter of Abu Sufyan. Anybody recognize him? Abu Sufyan, who is the leader of the Meccans after the Battle of Badr, right? So daughter of super enemy married here. Possibility that that is an attempt to kind of bridge the divide. We don't know. We also have some, the other marriages go the other way around. Here we actually have the wife of Zayd ibn Haritha, who is an adopted son. So we have a couple of political marriages, that line. We have a couple of marriages with daughters of Jewish leaders. So again, political attempts. We have another couple of tribal leaders, etc. So political marriage is one way of doing it. And if you only can marry once, well, then you can have one political alliance cemented. If you can marry more than once, you can cement more than one political alliance, right? So I just wanted to see that side of things. I'm not saying this is a good thing, I'm just saying there are, reasons. 625 is the year after the Battle of Uhud, right? That was a disastrous battle that the Muslims were fighting that they almost lost, you remember, right? So here we are a year later, and you have to remember, in a patriarchal society, it's possible that some women participated in battle, but they won't have been 50%, and they will not have been dying at the rate that that men were dying, right? So the situation you find yourself in is, you are in Medina as a religious community, you have left your home behind, and your families behind, to join this new enterprise, and now lots of men are dying on the battlefield, and women are left behind, widows. And those widows now have a choice, and the choice is, pre-Islamic times as far as we know, to go back to your family of origin, so you can go back to Mecca, to your polytheist parents, and they will take care of you. What's the drawback? You have to give up your religion, right? Because your parents are still in Mecca and they are polytheists. So, choice is between giving up your religion or being reintegrated into society in an imperfect system by marriage. Right? So, some Muslims argue polygamy was one way to take care of the widows, particularly in the early history of Islam, where many Muslim men were dying on the battlefield and leaving widows behind. You're following the argument. You don't have to agree, you just have to follow. Okay. So we have a number of those, and if you look at the list, what you're going to see is that except for one bride, every other bride that Muhammad married was either a widow or a divorcee. Right? There's only one misogynist language here, caution, virgin bride that Muhammad married. Okay? And that one's Aisha up here. So we have political marriages, we have what you may want to call social marriage, that is to say, reintegrating widows into societal structure, giving them protection through an imperfect system, admittedly. And then the third one, and that's a problematic one that we're going to explore in detail later, is what I would call pedagogical marriage, as weird as that sounds. And that's the marriage of
Zainab bint Jahsh in the year 628 or 629. No, sorry, 627, over here she is. Zainab, the story goes, blue blood, that is to say, high nobility, you may say, a wealthy family, very well-respected woman, who initially marries Muhammad's adopted son, Zayd ibn Haritha. Zayd ibn Haritha himself, a former slave that Muhammad adopted or took in, something to that effect, right? The two of them get married. The story has it that Muhammad one day visits his adopted son, Zayd, and he's not in, but his wife is in, and he sees her in not fully dressed state or something like that, and apparently is smitten. And of course, she is married, so he hides his desire, whatnot. Long story we're going to get into later. It's a complicated, messy story. It's a weird story. So the story continues. You know, she is occupying his heart after he's already seen and married so many women. And Zayd gets wind of this, sees that he always behaves weird around her, offers to divorce her so he may marry. And he, of course, says, no, your wife, I want to do that, and so forth. And then the Quran intervenes. And the Quran actually stipulates that he may marry her. I said it's weird, it is. We're going to read all that in more detail. I just want to get to the pedagogical part. So all of that stuff is going on. One of the questions that the marriage raises, though, is that ordinarily most incest taboos of Abrahamic traditions have it that a male may not marry the former wife of his son. Right? That would be weird. Right? So there's an incest taboo here. And the question is whether that incest taboo of biological filiation of a biological son also obtains and extends to incest taboos on adopted sons, right? So ultimately speaking, the question is, how does biological filiation, biological sonship, relate to social sonship, to adoptive sonship? You're following the question, right? And so what this pedagogical marriage, as weird as it is, ultimately speaking, is about is it is making the assertion biological sonship and social sonship are two different things. You are following this very convoluted, strange argument. So that's what we have here.
Just off topic, when in like 1625, the wife of Hasfa bint Amr.
Okay.
Does the fact that his daughter married Muhammad have anything to do with his change in like reign? Because we talked about in Ahmed's book how like
right.
his reign was a lot more.
Not to my knowledge. Hafsa is actually his sister, not his daughter, who gets him into Islam. But Umar is characterized in early sources for some reason or another, and almost in systematic and caricature form as the misogynist, macho, military male. Every single time you see him in the early sources, almost like a caricature, somebody does something wrong. I'm over-dramatizing here. Umar is coming in and suggesting chop off his head. Right? That's kind of Umar's line to a caricature form. Whereas Abu Bakr, the first caliph, is always in tears. He's always crying. It's kind of interesting to see, to look at it from a narrative perspective, and in all likelihood these are very early memories that Muslims have of these two leaders, one of them as the military, very assertive guy, that's Umar, versus the always weeping Abu Bakr. But yeah, so on this one, I'm not aware of any In addition to the wives, one concubine. Again, late antiquity, slavery is alive and well. According to tradition, Maria the Copt was an Egyptian slave given to Muhammad by the ruler of Egypt. Out of that union, we have the only other offspring. Right? The interesting thing is we have all of these wives, not a child out of any of the marriages, except this marriage, according to tradition. So Maria the Copt is getting pregnant with Ibrahim very late in Muhammad's career, but Ibrahim is also dying in childhood. Possibility is out there that Ibrahim, of course, is Abraham, who is actually the central figure of Islam, that this may actually be a later invention. We're not quite sure. Okay? So that's Muhammad's wives. We're going to get to that later. Elena.
Yes. I was wondering why, like, I think one of the books that we read, and I don't know which one, but they always said that, like, Aisha, yeah, that she was the favorite or something. And I don't know why.
Yes, Aisha is an interesting case. We're going to get to her later on in that, as I said, in the misogynist language, the only virgin bride, right? Not previously married bride. Also in terms of age, there's huge controversy how old she was when the marriage was contracted and consummated. That's another can of worms that I don't want to open today, going to be another day. But that is what many of the narratives have, who has a favorite one. And then you can imagine, if you think about this in historical, real-life terms, that many wives under one roof, actually, each of them having a separate quarter, right? So you have the mosque itself, and then the way tradition describes it, every single wife has her own apartment attached to the mosque. And then you have Muslim tradition or Quranic tradition developing that that males are polygamous males are supposed to be just to all of their wives. So you have that. Where does that obtain for Muhammad as well? Does he have to be equally just to all of his wives? What does it mean? That's a whole can of worms right there. Did wife A gets a new Mercedes? Does everybody else have to get a new Mercedes as well? What other times of justice and equality? There's a couple of sources that talk about knights. Every wife gets one knight with Muhammad in turn, and then you can give up your right to a knight and give it to somebody else. So, you know, where's justice there? So you have those assertions of equal treatment and equal regard on the one hand side, but then you also have assertions of the opposite of that, right? Of favoritism on his part, and then you have assertions on the part of the wives, of course, as wives of Muhammad, they are normative models, so all of them are the best women ever, never quibbling, but then you have the opposite as well, stories about quibbling. Right? And that says probably more about theological desires of the individual authors and what they want to bring about, or the points that they want to raise, and it says about historical accuracy. So we're going to get to some of that when we. And particularly when we read Barbara Strohwasser, some of the chapters that she has a chapter on that. Okay, so let's, for the time being, as a first stab on the history of, or the biography of Muhammad, close the book on that, and let's go in the last 50 minutes that we have very quickly to a first stab on the Quran. And of course, we're going to do a focused study of that one, you know, with various topics over the next couple of days. But in the first round, I had just to give you somewhat of a taste of the Quran, because most students in this class, actually beginning students, get a taste of it, see what we have. Right? So let's take these 15 minutes to collect, to collect some observations on these excerpts that I gave you. Of course, excerpts always a choice. I've given you a couple of verses that you may find familiarity with, that is to say, where you may find figures that you've come across before. Let's start with general observations on excerpts from the Quran. What do you think? Anything you found shocking, surprising, interesting? And names again.
Alice.
Alice.
One of the things that they mentioned a couple times was that Jesus was no more than a messenger.
Okay. So, first broad observation, Jesus is in there, right? But then, when it comes to him, lots of stuff being said that one may or may not agree with. The they, first of all, do very basic observations in the Quran. Who's talking? The text that you're reading, who's talking? Whose voice do we have in the Quran? What does Muslim tradition say on that? God himself, right? Now look at how is God talking himself. How does God refer to himself or herself? You have the text in front of you? Some of you do? Oh, the excerpts. I'm drunk, yes.
It's like in plural. It's like we instead of I.
Instead of I, right? So what's that about? We decree this. Remember when we did that. Why we? What may that be about? Is God plural? No, Muslims insist he's radically one, right? So what we have here is a majestatis pluralis, a plural of the majesties, right? Just like whenever I feel particularly good about myself, I may go into the plural mode. We think, right? I'm talking about myself, just in grandiose fashion. So, ipsissima verba of God. The very words of God is what we're reading according to Muslim tradition, right? And then I gave you the verses that I gave you because of familiarity and disfamiliarity to make a couple of broad observations on the Quran. It is the ipsissima verba. The verses that I gave you, you came across a number of folks that you know from elsewhere, right? So we come across Jesus, and we're going to talk about him more in a second. Who else we come across?
Moses.
Okay, Moses. And your name again?
Jordan.
So Moses in there, who else?
Alexis, Mary.
Okay. We came across Mary is what Alexis says. It's not that Mary says we came across Alexis. Who else?
Abraham,
over and over again, we've seen that, right? Who else?
Ishmael, Isaac, and Jacob.
I'm just abbreviating here because we're running out of time. So lots of folks that we came across. Next question. The folks that we're coming across, do you recognize them as the folks that we know? Most of us have some basic familiarity with biblical scripture, either through Bible itself or through cultural references. Do we recognize these folks as Moses, as Mary, as Abraham? And then ultimately speaking, of course, we're going to get to this guy. But these first, do we recognize them? Are they identical? Are they similar to biblical scripture? Are they different? What's your take on that? Alexis.
Mary seems really similar. She talks about how she like questions, like, how can I have a baby if no mortal has touched me?
Okay.
At least that's like a similar sort of method.
Okay. So, references to familiar stories in there, right? So there's some similarity. Let's talk for a second about the overall nature of the text. When you read the text, how does it come across to you? Particularly when you can compare it to biblical texts, what would you say are similarities and differences in, not in terms of content, but in terms of genre, in terms of literary tools used, in terms of the way that the narratives are constructed? What make some observations on that? How does this stack up against biblical narratives?
Are these numbers on the side, like verses?
Yes, so those are verses, right? So you have some vocab here. Quran, of course, is the text we're talking about, is subdivided into surah and ayah. Surah is chapter, right? And ayah is literally means sign, but it's verse. The Quran is arranged not according to the way it came down. That is to say, the first surah is not the first revelation. Anybody incidentally remember what I said? Ikra bismi rabbika, read in the name of thy Lord, is found where? Surah 96, verses 1 through 5. It's toward the very end, right? So it's not recorded from 1-1 all the way to 114, what have you, but rather the ordering in the Quran is different from revelatory order. You all following? So that is one of them. That's somewhat confusing. Another one, what is confusing? Does this read as smoothly as Harry Potter? Or, I don't know, Creighton or whatever you read? No. And your name?
Morgan.
Seems
less like narrative.
Okay.
Okay. And I would
say with the Bible. Okay. So, as far as the Bible is concerned, you have a narrative line, right? You have consecutive, reasonably and historically ordered lines. The beauty of the Bible overall is first page of the first book, beginning of creation, right? And then in one narrative line all the way to the end when everything stops. Right? So it kind of has this long narrative line, of course, with some interruptions. Do you have a narrative line in what you read? Not really. It's chopped up, right? It's piecemeal, a little bit on this, and then it jumps to the next topic. You remember this, and then it talks about that, and why don't you consider this, and remember when, and then it jumps, right? Jumps back and forth. And that's, of course, from a Muslim perspective, a function of the way it came down. Remember, it doesn't come down in one piece, but rather piece here, piece there, on it goes, right? It's not a narrative continuity, but rather it's chopped out. And then, you know, some people, particularly among the Orientalists, have complained about that. God, this is a chaotic text, you know, you can't make any sense of it, and it's contradictory and whatnot. You can also think about it in other ways. And you can think about it as a text that is responding to and in conversation with texts already on the ground. We would have to adjust our lens on pre-Islamic Arabia slightly, and that's what most historians do. And they would say, the Arabs actually were not idiots, right? In spite of Jahiliya, time of modernity, they were smart folks, and they had access to various civilizational achievements. They, after all, if they are traders, they're not quite in the middle of things, but they're close enough to civilization to know something about Bible, to know something about Talmud, to know something about the various folks out there. And the Quran is, in a sense, presupposing that, and is now making additional observations. It is, in a sense, adding to reinterpreting or challenging what we already know. Right? When you think, for example, about Jesus' character, if the Arabs really were the Jahiliyyah folks, these pre-Islamic ignorami, these pre-Islamic idiots, illiterate, who didn't know anything, were the just hopeless polytheists, it doesn't make any sense to have a Quran that has so much to say about Jesus. The text makes sense, or can be made sense of, by somebody who knows already something about Moses, about Jesus, about Abraham. If you know nothing about these folks, when you start reading the text, you're going to be even more confused than you were earlier. Are you following? So we assume from a historical critical perspective that the Arabs actually knew stuff about the Abrahamic traditions. And what the Quran now does is it gives you new insight, it gives you a different take on these folks. So having said, all of these folks, and then of course this guy, what does the Quran say on it? Broad question that we want to answer in the next 5 minutes is the Quran giving us the same Jesus? Is it the same guy? Or is it a totally different guy? Do we recognize him? Don't we recognize him? So what does the Quran have to say on Jesus? That is to say, agreements with Bible, I would say, and disagreements with Bible. Are there any agreements that the Quran has with the Bible? The Bible as you know it, or the Jesus as you know it? In what you read? And names again?
Morgan. He's created by, like, Immaculate Conception of
okay.
Allah.
Well, actually, just the quick vocab thing, immaculate conception versus virgin birth. Immaculate actually refers to the previous conception. This is actually a marriage. What you're talking about is actually Jesus himself, right? Virgin birth, right? That's just an observation on the Catholic doctrine of the Immaculate Conception.
So Immaculate Conception only refers to Jesus?
Mary.
Well, yeah. So
virgin birth, yes. Immaculate Conception, Mary. Virgin birth, Jesus. Both of them are misogynist. Did I say it? No, I didn't say that. Both of them are taken from a particular understanding of biology and a particular understanding of procreation, and have a theological point to them to preserve some type of notion of purity and miraculousness. But yeah, the terminology for immaculate conception is actually a rather recent one when it becomes Catholic dogma. That's not more than 200 years old versus virgin birth, ancient. Right. Not that ancient, actually. We're not on Bible here. We're in the Quran. Let's just give it at that. So virgin birth. What else? What else do you recognize? What else is in there as far as Jesus is characterized and named?
Jordan. Talks about the crucifixion and how.
What does it say about the crucifixion?
Oh, crap.
I didn't hear that.
And it talks about how Allah took him up.
Okay. So ultimately speaking, when it comes to the cross, not really. He wasn't crucified. Yeah. Something else going on. He was yanked out of, and he's up there somewhere. Okay, I don't see a whole lot of energy in the class right now that is eager to discuss this any further, given that we only have 2 minutes. My invitation to you, reread the piece. If possible, probably print it out, mark it up. The question that we're going to start out with on Tuesday. What does the Quran have to say on Jesus? What of the things that the Quran says about Jesus is something that is parallel to and in agreement with biblical portrayals? And what, if anything, is in disagreement? If you have highlighters, use green or some color for the agreements, and use another color for the disagreements, so that when we start this off on Tuesday, we can, in quick fire fashion, get through that. Okay? But continue reading as indicated on the syllabus. We're going to do Eve and others in the Quran as well. See you all on Tuesday.